KIOS-FM presents another luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, May 18, 2006, for broadcast at this time. On today's program, we'll hear a discussion of the topic methamphetamine, its dangers and treatment. The participants will be Jason Scott, who has been with the Nebraska State Patrol for the past 8 years and the Commercial Drug Interdiction Unit for the past 2 years, and Todd Stull, Assistant Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and the Medical Director of the University Drug and Alcohol Program. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of KIOS-FM, the Omaha Press Club, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Hugh Cowden, a member of the Omaha Press Club's Education Committee.
One is Investigator Jason Scott, who has been with the Nebraska State Patrol for the past 8 years and with the Commercial Drug Interdiction Unit for the past 2 years. He is also the SWAT team leader for the State Patrol in Omaha and has had plenty of experience cleaning out meth labs. Our other panelist is Dr. Todd Stull, a member of the Department of Psychiatry faculty at the University of Nebraska Medical Center and the medical director of the University Drug and Alcohol Program. He is a 1992 graduate of UNMC and is board certified in general and addiction psychiatry. Dr. Stull is especially interested in educating the public about mental illness and addiction. Please join me in welcoming our panelists, if you will. And we'll begin with Investigator Scott. There will be time for questions after they have finished speaking. You have paper and pencils at your table. If you could write your questions and someone will pick them up. So let me begin with Investigator Scott.
Good afternoon. As Mr. Cowden said, I've been with the patrol for 8 years. I am the SWAT team leader, so by policy, we deal with all the meth lab search warrants, things of that nature. And we, as many people know, most of the things that we're up against these days in law enforcement surround methamphetamine, whether it's theft, murder, drug use in general. Everything seems to have some sort of nexus with methamphetamine. And as you know, the legislation that's currently passed, if you've been to the store and you've bought Sudafed in the last 6 months or so, you know that you have to sign your life away when you buy that. As much as it may seem like an inconvenience, it's the best thing that Nebraska has done to combat this methamphetamine thing in a long time. Oklahoma kind of led the legislation on this across the country, experienced a 60% drop in meth labs over the first year. And I suspect, as things are looking currently, that this year we will probably see 60% or better in our state as well. The thing with methamphetamine is that it's the availability, that each and every one of us right now probably has the components to make at least a personal use amount of methamphetamine in your house right now, whether you know it or not. And that therein lies the problem, because everybody can get their hands on it. Unlike cocaine, or marijuana or anything that requires a lot of money, methamphetamine can be made, and they're making it in bathtubs, hotel rooms, trucks, trailers, anywhere you can think of that you can get a coffee pot and a filter, they'll come up with a batch of methamphetamine. As far as the meth goes, I'm not going to try and steal any of the doctor's thunder as far as the psychiatric stuff, but the meth itself, as far as appearance, depends on the chemicals that were used to make it. If a lot of green fuel or red fuel was used in somewhere in the process, then the end product will have red or greenish tint to it. But it's basically a powder crystalline substance, sometimes found in a rock type substance. It's been likened to the odor of cat urine, and for those of you like me who have never had that privilege, it's foul and it's pungent, and it's kind of striking to you. You really probably haven't smelled much like it, and it would kind of seem alarming to you that there's a strong chemical odor. A lot of times the odor that's associated with meth labs is anhydrous, and if you haven't had that experience, there's no mistaking that either. And as you know, anhydrous can kill you. But if you walk into something like that, there's no mistaking it, the odor, even if it's a neighbor or something to that effect, you'll know when you smell the anhydrous. There's one precursor in methamphetamine, and what I mean by that is there's only one substance that's there in the beginning, that's there in the end, and if you don't have it, you'll never have methamphetamine. That's Sudafed. That's why the ephedrine. That's why the ephedrine legislation was so important, because if they could get control of that, in theory, you've gained a little bit of control on the homemade methamphetamine by controlling whose hands that's getting into. You or I have come up with a cold. We may go to the store, and even if it's on sale, we may buy two boxes. But very few of us have bought 10, 20, 100, 1,000 boxes of Sudafed at a time. So the theory there was we need to gain control, and that's what that legislation was about. But they've found a way, and when I say they, I mean the people manufacturing methamphetamine, have found a way around all the other ingredients that are in methamphetamine. They can make their own iodine crystals, mixing certain chemicals, and they can make their own anhydrous, and they can steal anhydrous, and there's a lot of things that they can fake, but what they can't fake is the ephedrine. We recently have found out that these people have located another source of ephedrine that's not controlled, and it's in tack shops, which we all are veterinary shops, for if you don't know what I'm talking about. There's a ton of them in Nebraska, obviously. And there's a medication that's for horses that is very high in ephedrine, and they've since figured that out. There was a little experiment ran. Typically, farmers or people that need this substance would buy a jar of it, and it would last you a lifetime as a farmer or somebody raising animals. And they noticed that people were coming in and kind of cleaning off the shelf and buying everything they had. So they doubled the price on it and started documenting who was coming in to buy it. They put it up to like $100 and some a bottle, and they were still coming in and cleaning the shelf off and buying it up. So that's going to be some separate legislature there, but we're working on that. It's a central nervous system stimulant, and like I said, I don't want to steal too much of his thunder, but we've ran into people in my experience, and I should have started with this. I'm a drug investigator. I'm not a public speaker, but from time to time we do these things because the information is key to get out there. And the best thing I can do is open it up for questions for you guys so I can answer your questions through my experiences. But expert may be a stretch, but I've dealt with a lot of methamphetamine and a lot of people using methamphetamine and taking down labs. That being said, it's a central nervous system stimulant, and I've talked to people that have been up for 28 days at a time. That being said, they crash really hard, and they're very violent. It does suppress their appetite, so you see weight loss and that sort of thing. Hygiene is usually the first thing to go on these people, and I don't know how much of that he's going to cover. But I will answer any of those types of questions. But I suspect many of us in this room may have seen somebody that we thought maybe using methamphetamine. Very fidgety, can't sit still. Hygiene is atrocious. Teeth are falling out. They get what we call meth mites. It's where the chemicals popping through the skin, and they'll scratch these little sores until they're covered. It kind of looks like chicken pox. Unclean, unkept. We call it meth breath, but it's just a terrible odor that emits from them, and it's all this chemical that was never intended to be put in your body that's kind of exuding itself. And like I said, they're very violent people, high propensity for violence, very paranoid. And without delving too much into his, the way it was explained to me was there are certain people in the world that are born with a certain portion of their brain that's destroyed, and we call those people paranoid schizophrenics because it's the same exact portion of the brain that meth destroys. So basically what you have is a chemically induced paranoid schizophrenic because it's attacking the same part of the brain. And I don't want to steal his thunder on that, but you can see what we're up against. It's the availability. I've arrested 14-year-old girls from West Omaha to 70-year-old men driving across the country. So unlike cocaine, LSD, ecstasy, that have a stereotype to them, methamphetamines cross in every boundary, irregardless of race, sex, age, whatever. Everybody's using it, and it's because of the availability. With the legislation, what you need to understand is we call the local labs here that we get, for the most part, are what we call Beavis and Butthead labs or mom-pop labs. They were cooked or set up with the intent of feeding this person their habit for that night and maybe giving them enough money to go buy more supplies to continue to feed their habit. Phoenix, California, Missouri, they're dealing with super labs that were put there by the Hispanic crime organizations out of Mexico, and they're dealing, you know, with huge labs putting out hundreds of pounds at a time. We're not there, but the problem is it takes the same amount of money to clean up that 500-pound lab as it does that half-gram lab, because it's all the same chemicals. You're dealing with federal standards from EPA and stuff like that. It's a very hazardous environment. You have gases like phosgene and phosphine gases that are odorless, colorless, and will kill you in an instant in a parts per million level. I mean, it takes very little of this stuff. So if you see us on the news, you probably see us going in with SCBA or the breathers, look kind of like the fireman thing with the air and all that stuff. It's because it's an incredibly dangerous environment. But the problem is it takes the same amount of money to clean those small labs up as it does the big lab. So our next thing to combat is, of course, the trafficking into, because now we've upset the Mexican crime organizations down there with all this ephedrine. Legislature is going crazy on the states that are really affected by meth, the Midwest and West Coast, Southwest in particular. So the smuggling has increased, because if we can't make it in the United States, we can sure smuggle it in either way. With everything that's going on with President Bush and the border and everything else, we're anticipating a huge push of narcotics into the United States, because they know that the border is going to be shut down here real soon. So kind of preemptive to that, we would anticipate that those organizations are going to push as hard as they ever have to get the product up here. And we're combating those with units, those people, with units like the one that I'm assigned to, the commercial interdiction unit. I work the airport, bus station, truck stops, any mode of commercial transport, we work, and we try to interdict the people that are just muling the narcotics, is a term that we use, or they're just transporting it and smuggling it across the country. It's not expensive. It's fairly cheap as far as getting a user amount. You know, $10 to $20 will get you there, so you'll see petty theft and stuff like that with these people. They'll strip everything out of their house that they could possibly sell, window AC units, electrical fixtures. I mean, everything is, plus they're up for 28 days, so what else is there to do besides take your house apart and find out what you could hawk? Winging it, that's about all I have for now. Hope I don't know if they got the PowerPoint going or not, but I'll be more than welcome to answer any questions that you have, and that's probably the best way for me to do this at this point. Thanks.
Thank you, Jason. Let me introduce again Dr. Todd Stull of the University of Nebraska Medical Center, who will be talking about the treatment of methamphetamine addicts. Again, let me welcome Dr. Stull.
Thank you, and thanks for asking me to come here today. Amphetamines have been around for a long time. They were made in Germany in the late 1800s, and came to the United States in the 1900s, and then in about the 1960s, they came out in a form called Prope Dope, or Biker's Coffee, or Biker's Speed. And it was after that they started to be used more extensively and then modified. And over time, chemically they were changed a little bit to come up with ice, or what we know now as methamphetamine or crank, sometimes called Tina or glass, and it has those appearances. And it's very potent. In fact, it clearly is a drug of choice for many people. When we look at the data in terms of who kind of uses meth and why, a little over 6% of high school seniors have actually tried methamphetamine nationwide. When we break it down even further, roughly about 15 to 20% of users that are less than 18 years old, and between the 18 and 34-year age group, it's the largest percent. So that's roughly half or 50% of the users. And then above the age of 34, we still have about 33% of people that are meth users. And this has already been said with arresting older people that are using it, but it's quite remarkable. It's the second most common illicit drug used worldwide behind marijuana. So sometimes we think, oh, it's other things, but it's actually methamphetamine. And as you've already heard, it's easy to make and readily available. In 2002, when you looked across the United States at the Mexican ice that was imported, there was just a few states. And when you look at that same graphic in 2005, covered pretty much the entire United States. Every state had reported, pretty much with the exception of a couple, methamphetamine use or it being imported. In 1999, I think there were roughly less than 30, I think, meth labs that were busted here, arrested here in Nebraska, and that number had gone well into the hundred. I think it was over 200 by 2005. It clearly has moved across from the West Coast into the Midwest, and now is moving east. But Missouri, Iowa, Tennessee have very high numbers of clandestine labs that have been arrested. It's not just the toxins, too, from using meth that are harmful, but those that are around, the kids that are around, can get on their clothing, it can get spread throughout the house. And many of these things are very toxic to human beings. So it's not just the users that are having problems. Why do people use methamphetamine? Well, initially, probably it's the idea of giving you a little more energy, or maybe weight loss, or experimentation, or just seeing how it makes you feel, or helping you concentrate for longer periods of time. But then individuals that start using that seem to have this kind of predisposition to becoming addicted may use more and more over time, or get into a cyclic pattern of using. And they look for that feeling that they had before. They look for that euphoria, or being on top of the world, or enhanced kind of sexual feelings, decreased need for sleep, increased energy. They look for that rush, and they feel great with it, many of the individuals that do. But not everybody that uses it gets that high. Some people that use actually get agitated and irritable on their first time use. They don't get that euphoria. They don't get that great feeling, and, you know, my troubles don't bother me anymore, that kind of feeling over time. As someone progresses with their use, though, they start to have other kinds of effects. It can affect their emotional state. It can affect their thinking. It can affect their behavior. And eventually some people that are using can actually become addicted to it. Or dependent on it. And when we talk about addiction, I want you to think of the concept of addiction along a spectrum, because there are people that have mild addictions, some that have moderate, and some that have severe. And so not everybody that uses methamphetamine is going to become severely addicted to it. Let me draw an analogy. When you think of an individual, and I use this example frequently, so those of you that have maybe heard me talk before, I'm going to go back to my diabetes example because people can relate to that. There are people that have mild diabetes that are a little bit overweight, and they can exercise, and by exercising and losing weight and watching what they eat, they can prevent themselves from having diabetes or the need to take a medication. However, there are next point, that's the equivalent of the addict who can kind of pull themselves up by the bootstraps, okay? There's not many of those, but there are some that can. And it's a misconception within our culture. You just suck it up and pull yourself up by the bootstraps. If you move down the spectrum of diabetes, some individuals will do all those things I've talked about and still need to take a medication. That's the equivalent of the addict who needs to be in treatment, maybe for a short to medium time period. As you progress further down the spectrum of diabetes, you get into more severe type 1 diabetes. Those individuals they need insulin. If they don't have insulin, they die. It's not a choice. There are addicts that have that degree of addiction, meaning that their addiction is so severe that there are neurochemical changes in their brain. That is, their chemistry changes in their brain, and no amount of willpower is going to get you out of that. I'm gonna talk about the idea of addiction right here, just so you know what I'm talking about. It's more than just craving. It's more than loss of control. It's more than using that drug despite bad things happening to you. It's more than the compulsive nature of using. If somebody's addicted, they're losing things. They're losing their self-esteem. Their health's deteriorating. They're losing their family support. They are losing their job often. They're hawking their possessions. Life's falling apart. Life really stinks for these individuals. I've never met, and I say this all the time, I've never met somebody who wakes up and says, geez, wouldn't it be great if I was a diabetic? But guess what? I don't mean anybody that wakes up and says, gee, I sure hope I'm an addict. Wouldn't that be great? Because addiction means loss, okay? I meet people every day that like to get high and like the effects of getting high, but not what addiction means. And so by the time these individuals are at that point, then we're talking about the methamphetamine users, things are not going well. It usually starts out with a deterioration of their hygiene, and you've already heard this, but then it progresses into other kinds of problems. These individuals, and methamphetamine now, in fact, years ago, we would say syphilis was the great masquerader of many medical problems. Now it's methamphetamine because there's so many organ systems that methamphetamine affects. Not only does it affect the brain and it can cause strokes and seizures and hemorrhages, but it can cause heart disease, it can cause arrhythmias, it can cause hypertension, it can cause obstetric complications. Many individuals that are methamphetamine users have sexually transmitted diseases. Hepatitis C is very common in this area. Many of them have kidney problems, lung problems, on and on and on. So it affects numerous organ systems. And Jason alluded to this earlier. People like to smoke methamphetamine because it lasts longer. When you smoke it, its effects start in about 5 to 10 seconds, but then lasts anywhere from 12 to 24 hours. That can be a long time, and it's inexpensive. If you smoke a rock of cocaine, the freebase cocaine, the effects last about roughly 5 to 10 minutes, maybe a little longer, not very long. We're talking hours here. So many of these people that are using meth are up for days. Let's go through the cycles of meth. But initially, somebody uses in a binge pattern, and they're searching for that euphoria. They want to get high. They want to feel good. And so they feel elated. Well, they keep using, trying to get to that, but can't because the effects diminish over time. And as they continue to binge, they're often awake for longer periods of time. And then after they get into this cycle, they up and they start to get into a phase called tweaking. And when they tweak, there's some unusual terms that people will use when they tweak, but these individuals are up for extended periods of time. They're agitated. They may be psychotic during this time, but they're doing things that are referred to as geeking, or they're spun out. And when somebody's spun out, they'll do the same behavior over and over and over for hours. So they may walk the same aisle in Walmart for 7 or 8 or 10 hours, over and over and over. Or they may sit and pick their toenails for hours on end. And that's when someone's spun out. Then they'll crash, and the crash lasts usually 1 to 3 days, occasionally longer. They don't feel good, and so they go back into another binge and then back into the withdrawal phase. And then often the cycle repeats itself. After somebody's used long enough, it starts to affect our brain and our brain chemistry. We know that, for example, a chemical in our brain that's associated with this is called dopamine. I just am curious, how many of you have heard of this dopamine, or the chemical dopamine? So it's not new. It's a chemical in our brain that communicates with nerve cells. We have emotions that are associated with dopamine, but a dopamine also has to do with our sex drive, our attention, our movement, some of those kinds of activities. people that have too little or small amounts of dopamine in an area called the basal ganglia, for example, get Parkinson's disease. People that have too much dopamine get psychotic. So some individuals that have schizophrenia, if they get too much dopamine in their brain, that brings on psychotic symptoms. Well, dopamine is this kind of feel-good chemical, and within the reward areas of the brain, when somebody uses methamphetamine, it actually causes a huge release of dopamine. So there's a big gush. As it comes out of this area, it goes to another area that registers feeling. So that's where you're feeling good. And then there's connections that go out into the memory area of our brain and then into the other kind of the cortex or outer layer of our brain. So we process what's going on around. So we're taking in not only the feeling and remembering what's going on, but we're associating it with maybe individuals that are around us or certain circumstances in which we use. After a while, this signal gets stamped in. I'm going to tell you what I mean by being stamped in. I want you to think a little bit of Pavlov's dog here now for a second. And I'm going to use cocaine or methamphetamine as an example. If I'm a heavy meth user and I've been using a long time and I'm addicted to it, and I come in and there's a pipe with meth in it in front of me, even without me using, these areas in my brain that have been stimulated over time and activated will become activated at the sight of it. Or if I've used, I know Kay out here, so I'm going to say, if I've used with Kay, I'm going to pick on you a little bit, Kay, and Kay and I hang out together, and every time pretty much we're together, we use meth. If I see her, those same areas in my brain are going to become activated, just like Pavlov's dog salivates. It's not a conscious thing. It's not something I'm trying to do. It just happens. That new signal gets stamped in. And for many individuals, that doesn't change. That's the way they are. That's what they're left with. It may revert back a little bit to kind of a different state, but often not to their pre-using state. So they have this new kind of signal within their brain, and their brain is sending them the idea that they need this. So no amount of willpower is going to overcome something like that. That's a little bit about kind of the idea of what dopamine does in our brain and with this process, and that's why they often are seeking the methamphetamine. Now, just so happens that most of the other substances that we know about, whether it's methamphetamine or cocaine or the opiates, do the same kind of thing. And this is fairly new data, new information. What happens, and there's three other things I want to talk to you about before we talk a little bit about treatment. And the first is what happens to our thinking or our cognitive abilities. Because we know, for example, some of the ingredients within methamphetamine and some of the breakdown products of dopamine are toxic to brain cells. And over time, we'll see that when someone's using, it'll affect their ability to pay attention or concentrate. It'll affect their ability to or their judgment. It'll affect their memory. It'll affect their abstract thinking. And if somebody quits using over time, then those areas kind of come back online. But those individuals that have used for a long period of time, their verbal memory and their visual memory usually don't improve. And so they will end up with some cognitive problems that can have long-lasting effects. What about individuals that have mood problems or depression? Well, about 30 to 50% of people that have that are addicted to methamphetamine will have a separate mood disorder, meaning major depression most commonly. And it can be drug-induced, it can be methamphetamine-induced, but more commonly, it coexists with the methamphetamine dependence. And many of those individuals need treatment for their depression. In fact, when you look at a methamphetamine user, one of the most common complaints they have after they've quit, after they've become abstinent, and they're not in withdrawal, is they have no energy, no motivation, and they don't enjoy things. They don't derive any pleasure from activities that they do. Why? Because they've killed some of those dopamine-producing cells in their brain, and they haven't come back. And for some individuals, they don't come back, or they'll come back only in small amounts. There also are individuals that become psychotic. Remember I mentioned the tweaking phase when they're up for days and they've been using meth, they've been on a binge, they can see things, or they can hear things, or they can feel things. So they have those, sometimes they're called mites, sometimes they're called crank bugs. They're tactile hallucinations, and they will pick or dig at their skin, or sometimes try to dig them out or burn them out, and it's a hallucination. There's nothing actually there. Persecutory delusions are the most common. Someone's after me, someone's going to get me, someone's going to harm me. That's often when they'll get violent or aggressive or agitated too. Those things can get better, but they can persist. Remember the kamikaze pilots from World War II that used amphetamine? Some of them ended up with chronic psychoses. And that's the same process we're talking about here, only several orders of magnitude higher, because meth is more potent than the amphetamine they used during World War II. When we talk about, so I've talked a little bit about the cognitive effects, the effects on mood, and the effects on, or some of the psychotic effects. Let's finish now with talking about treatment. When we talk about treatment, there are different options. There's inpatient, outpatient, partial hospitalization, or residential treatment. Depending on the severity of their addiction and the extent of their addiction will determine largely where they end up. And then the treatment modality that's offered, whether it's a 12-step approach such as AA, which is common in the area and proven useful, or cognitive behavioral therapy, which is another type, which again is proven useful, or motivational enhancement therapy, it doesn't so much matter. Some treatments work better for some individuals, some work better for others. What I can say, there are two things that determine outcome from drug treatment that's no different with methamphetamine. One is psychiatric comorbidity. So untreated mental illness, the outcome is worse. If you don't treat the coexisting mental illness, the outcome is worse. And remember that 75% of people that have a drug addiction have a mental illness, so three-fourths of them. The other thing that determines outcome for people that have an addiction is length of treatment. We have this notion. Remember, I've talked to you about the cognitive effects. Well, the same thing happens with people that have alcohol problems. So we put these people into treatment right after they finish drinking or using meth, and we put them into a 28-day treatment program. We have this great idea. We're going to put them into a 28-day treatment program. Well, good luck, because it's really usually money down the drain for many of them, because they haven't come back online cognitively. They need to be in treatment for an extended period of time. Often we're talking several months, and treatment can't stop then. Remember that to get to this level of addiction, if somebody's got a severe addiction, it doesn't happen overnight. It happens over months or usually even years, because they've used other drugs before that. Most people don't just dig right into methamphetamine. They're using other gateway drugs before that. And so treatment needs to happen over an extended period of time. Let's go back to our type 1 diabetics. You have diabetes type 1 the rest of your life. You don't wake up one day and say, well, I'm not going to have it anymore. I'm just going to will my way out of this. It's going to go away. It doesn't happen. So you got to check sugars. You got to monitor your diet. It's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year, the rest of your life. Many of these people that have that level of addiction need to live their life like a type 1 diabetic. They have to change their peer group. They have to change their activities. They have to fill in their using times with some other activity. They have to work a program. They need a supportive network. Those people that will call them to the carpet when they're messing up or their thinking gets a little bit off. And they need family involvement. And this is every day. You don't take days off from this, because those days off are the days you slip and get back into the cycle of using, or when your life deteriorates again. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Stoll. Let me ask the first question, basic question. What are the different ways in which meth can be ingested? Either one?
I'll answer that. What we see is there's multi routes of ingestion on methamphetamine. Any way they can get it in the body, they will. But what we see is it's smoked or snorted, and there is a small group of people that likes to inject as well. But any way they can get it in the system.
Anything to add, Dr. Still?
No, just kind of the four standard routes for most. You know, it's like cocaine. You can take it orally, you can snort it, you can smoke it, or you can shoot it. On the street, they call it banging, usually when they shoot it. And but smoking is the preferred route because it lasts longer, usually.
This is to Investigator Scott. Can you talk about the children found in these meth labs? How often, how many, how young? In general, the effects on kids.
Well, first off, the effects on kids is we've got babies being born addicted to meth, so there's one battle. As far as houses with search warrants and stuff like that, it's inevitable, it seems to me, that there's always kids involved in one form or another. It may not be a large lab, or they may not be in the lab area, but the chemicals that are in these labs are tracked everywhere. That is the reason why we get in Tyvek suits and booties and air breathing stuff, because we take that home with us, and I don't want to take it home to my kids, you know, and just like you don't. Well, the problem is these people track because they feel like they're cooking in the basement of the house. Their kids are safe upstairs, and they're tracking everything. Gases are seeping everywhere. Their kids go to the basement anyway. I guess the answer to that problem from my perspective is there needs to be better legislation to prosecute these people for endangering these kids the way they are.
It's my understanding that drug companies resisted efforts in the 1980s that would have sharply reduced the availability of key ingredients. Can either of you comment on this?
The one thing that comes to my mind is I know that OxyContin is a name brand drug. That company loves the fact that millions of people are becoming addicted to OxyContin. From a drug producing company standpoint, why would you want to combat the methamphetamine when you're selling it like crazy, or it's being used like crazy? I think it's kind of the same with OxyContin. If I could have bought stock in OxyContin 5 years ago, I'd be rich. But I think that's the reason you see resistance from the drug companies, is because they're moving a lot of product. They don't want to see it go away. That's my perspective.
A recent news report mentions a high rate of cancer in first responders in meth lab raids. Is that a concern in Nebraska?
It's a huge concern, especially for me, because I'm in them, and everybody in our line of work. Real quick, the Jewish Women's League in Utah, I believe it was, did a study a few years back, and they were going back to apartment complexes and hotels and things like this where meth had been cooked, and they were swabbing specifically for methamphetamine so as to avoid getting one of the components, you know, like an ammonia or something like this, to pop positive. They were swabbing vents and ceiling fans and stuff like this specifically for methamphetamine, and this had been years down the road. They were finding levels of methamphetamine that were so high they should not have met the occupants and rating to put somebody else back in that apartment or that hotel or anything. It should have been bulldozed. And they were finding this 4, 5, 6 stories away from where the meth was originally produced. Huge concern. I don't have an answer there really, other than our safety precautions on our end and further studies tracking, because I'm not anywhere near the first person to step in a methamphetamine lab in regards to first responders, police, and fire. They've been doing this for years. They need to be talking to the people that have been retired and start looking at why there's so many cancer outbreaks in those people, and maybe do some history there.
Is meth addiction more debilitating than heroin or cocaine? Dr. Stowe?
We know that probably when you talk about populations, the most addictive substance is nicotine. 1 out of 3 people that use nicotine will become addicted. Approximately between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 people that use an opiate, such as heroin or OxyContin, are the most common opiate that people are addicted to is actually Vicodin in the United States, become addicted. So 1 of 4 and 1 of 5. And methamphetamine is right in that neighborhood. Cocaine's about 1 out of 6 people that use. One of the factors that contributes to addiction, and I mentioned the chemical dopamine before, there's a receptor in our brain called a D2 receptor, dopamine 2 receptor. Individuals that have a lower level of D2 in their brain tend to have a more favorable or euphoric kind of response and a predisposition from what we know of becoming addicted to methamphetamine or, for that matter, cocaine, because they work very similar. So it's very similar to, from what we know at this point, to heroin or the opiates in general.
This is a related follow-up question. If chemicals are so dangerous, why don't more people die?
During the natural history and the course of substance use, those individuals that are addicted, you'll find, don't have the same longevity in terms of their lifespan. They do die. We don't often hear about them. They die of things like endocarditis, and the cause of death is or pneumonia or pulmonary complications or a stroke, and the cause of death will be they had heart problems or they had lung problems, when in actuality they were induced by the stimulant that they're using, whether it's cocaine or methamphetamine. So they do die from them.
I would agree as well. I've been to crime scenes where people are cooking methamphetamine and they die 4 feet outside the front door because their lungs have burned up, but it's never reported that way. It was complications with breathing. Well, it was due to the anhydrous that he just took in, you know, or something to that effect. And I suspect it also has to do with them building a tolerance to all that stuff. Their bodies, you know, dealing in and around it, putting it in their bodies, standing around that stuff day in and day out, I would imagine they build some sort of an immunity.
I have heard that most people are addicted to meth after just one use. Is this true?
The short answer is no, not really. But it's the because addiction is a pattern of behavior over time where an individual craves the substance, loses their ability to control their use. They use it despite bad things happening. You know, we mentioned earlier there was a question about children. Not too long ago, there was a woman in California that was addicted to meth. She had 4 kids in her trailer house, and one of the kids made it out alive, and she saved her meth lab, none of the kids. That's addiction. But that doesn't happen overnight. It's a pattern of behavior that develops. Could you have a euphoric effect and feel great and on top of the world and be the start of you becoming addicted to it after first-time use? You bet. But the true pattern or behavior doesn't happen after a time or two. It's a process over time.
Can you can you explain some of the lingo associated with meth so that I can be aware as an in-home worker? I have heard terms such as teener, eight ball, etc.
From my perspective, whoever that may be, you may be in and around somebody that's dealing because those are dealer quantities. Teener, eight ball is an eighth of an ounce. You know, they're referring to the amount of dope that's being bought. It's called numerous things, from crank to ice. You guys probably have heard a little bit about the ice methamphetamine in the media, because for whatever reason, ice draws a bigger interest. It is not, in my experience, is not a pure form, even though it's reported that way. It's a cleaner form, and what I mean by that is it's a longer process. They clean the dope up. They wash it twice, basically, is what they're doing when they have ice. But they'll charge you twice as much because somebody told you ice meth is the best meth you can get. This ice is awesome. Well, in fact, when we test, we've found regular methamphetamine with higher levels of purity than we have in the ice. It's just a marketing thing amongst drug users.
Mm-hmm. What are the most common initial use forms of meth at the teen high school level? And is ecstasy a form?
Ecstasy does have amphetamine in it. And my experience, ecstasy is very unique because it's a very small group of people. It's very tight-knit, and it's usually all the way down from grade school to college-age kids. But typically, your rave scene is high into ecstasy-type exotic drugs. But as far as methamphetamine use in young kids, my experience has been generally younger white females telling you that somebody sold them on the fact that they would lose weight if they would use methamphetamine.
I would agree with that. Yeah. One thing to add to that is the sometimes it starts out as a buying an over-the-counter weight loss medication that has ephedrine in it, or used to be there was phenylpropanolamine in it, and they don't sell that anymore now. It's been taken off the market. The other thing about ecstasy is that it the effects are a little bit different in that it is a not only has amphetamine in it, but it has a hallucinogen in it like mescaline. And so you get a stimulant effect but also a hallucinogenic effect. And these individuals that use it often will describe feeling a warmth, a connectedness with the individuals they're with as if they're bonding or melding with them. And they have heightened sexual feelings. And unless they have a lot of amphetamine in it, it tends to avoid some of the agitated feeling that you can just get with pure meth.
How effective have the restrictions been on pseudoephedrine sales? Have you seen a corresponding drop in meth lab busts?
Without a doubt. Like I said, I haven't seen any specific numbers for this year, but I was told, and from everything I've experienced just in my day-to-day job, it's been a long time since I've been to a lab, knock on wood, and I like it that way. But we're going to see better than probably 60% drop, much like Oklahoma did, I suspect. So it's had a huge impact.
Do landlords and realtors have to let tenants know if the residence was used as a meth lab previously?
Yes, they're supposed to. California is kind of leading some new ground here on this thing too, because they've gone to just seizing the house and bulldozing it and there's no problem. But in an apartment complex or rental property, something along those lines, motel, I'm not sure what their answer is, but if it's anything that the state could seize, California's, I don't know that Nebraska's going to go there anytime soon, but it's a pretty good solution to the problem, because I suspect there's probably a lot of rental properties and hotel rooms and stuff that have been used in that nobody has any idea. Mm. And it comes back to reporting too, which is another issue amongst law enforcement, the reporting aspect. You may recall he mentioned the number of labs that were reported in 1999 to 2005 and the huge increase, partly due to the fact that the reporting guidelines for agencies changed dramatically in that time frame too, because Missouri, for example, it was documented that one of the first people to do a meth lab in the United States was planted by the Mexican mafia in Missouri with a recipe to do nothing but distribute this and teach people how to make meth, but they weren't reporting any, and it was just a reporting standardization thing. And then all of a sudden in 2005, they're number three in the country. So it has to do with some reporting standards too.
I don't know if there is an answer to this one, but if we are going to be stuck with meth and addicts, would there be any merit for the state to license it and tax it?
I say no.
I don't know the answer to that. I kind of doubt it, but I haven't thought about that issue, I guess, so I don't know. There's one other question I have. Are you done with the questions over there? I've got one that was passed over here.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. The question is, has there been any medications that are useful for treating addictions, or in this case methamphetamine, and how about Wellbutrin? Wellbutrin is an antidepressant that has actually an amphetamine-like ring structure. Nothing has proven useful for treating methamphetamine addiction at this point in time. We're getting closer, and mainly getting closer with cocaine. There are some, there's work on a vaccine, but there's also some other medicines that are being used that I occasionally will use in some patients that have been effective, but nothing that's useful. If they have coexisting or depression or a psychotic disorder, then medication is often useful for those co-occurring problems, but nothing specific for methamphetamine at this point in time.
That that's similar to a question that I had up here that I had misplaced. The number of high school dropouts has been increasing recently. Do you think much of this has been due to meth?
I think it's a larger problem than methamphetamine. I think we have a cultural change where not only are people more mobile and have more jobs, but divorce rate is very high. You have both parents that are working. Kids are left sometimes unattended, but there are other expectations sometimes that we have with our children. And so I think there's a number of things that are happening that are well outside the purview of methamphetamine that are creating that particular problem.
Does meth attract males and females equally?
Yes, absolutely. That's been my experience anyway. I'm sure he can tell you about the people showing up.
If you look at the worldwide data, it's about a 60-40 split, roughly, 60%. So, yeah, I mean, it's roughly the same.
Mr. Scott, can you describe the most dangerous episode that you have experienced in breaking up meth labs?
One of our main concerns when we go in these things is obviously an oxygen level. That being said, we're a little bit concerned with discharging a firearm inside of a gas tank, basically. And any time you've got paranoid people who've been up for 28 days that are very agitated and psychotic, and they're paranoid because the FBI's had a satellite over their house for the last 30 days anyway, and all of a sudden there's guys in little suits coming in with air tanks and guns pointed at them and all this kind of stuff, it's a wonder that nothing bad has happened, knock on wood. But for whatever reason, they have a propensity to throw chemicals at us because they can't get to a weapon or whatever. It may be more psychiatric than I'm even aware of what the tie there is, but you get that a lot. It's very concerning to us when you get officers that are doused with, you know, all kinds of chemicals, and you have people that attempt to set fire to things and stuff like that, and they're always uncooperative.
Anything to add, Dr. Stone?
I think your point's well taken. Judgment is so impaired in these individuals. They're often, when they're either been on a binge or been using for extended periods of time, and they're maybe even into a tweaking phase, and they're irrational and impulsive, disinhibited, and very unpredictable. So certainly my hat's off to the group of individuals that have to go out and deal with them during this time, because it can be very scary, and lots of bad things can happen.
I guess the other thing there that I would add is that you have to remember at what point I'm dealing with them and what point he may be dealing with them. Things have obviously gotten real bad by the time that I get to these people. They are in a tweaking phase, or they're spun out, or whatever. It's not the two-time user that, you know, just bad luck, you know, they caught me. It's typically pretty bad, and it's been a long history of use and addiction and everything else, so...
This is for either of you or both of you. Do you think that publicity about the serious dangers of meth has reduced its use?
I'll let you go first.
I think so. I think it has been helpful. And I think the more we can educate the public, and starting at a young age, and putting in usable concepts or ideas for younger kids, the more effective it's going to be. But I think there is some benefit into the education.
There has been a shift toward community-based care, like the Campus for Hope that's run by Catholic Charities in Omaha for persons with behavioral health problems. Has this been helpful in the treatment of meth addicts?
Limited.
Pardon?
I think no. I think very limited. And it's not that they're not trying. I think there needs to be more resources poured into it, more money, more support. For every dollar spent, there's $4 to $7 that are saved. This has been documented time and time again when you look at addiction studies. And so my answer is there needs we need more.
Again, this is for Dr. Stull. Is there a plan to increase the number of substance abuse professionals in Nebraska?
Yes, but I don't know much about the plan and the extent of it or how that's going to be done and when it's going to be done. And hopefully it'll be a part of this whole mental health reform, and substance will be included with that.
We're just about out of time. Is there anything further, maybe a question that has not been asked that either of you would like to address?
I can't think of it. If somebody has something, I'd be happy to answer it. It's a huge battle that we're up against on both sides of the fence from a treatment standpoint, from a law enforcement standpoint. I'm willing to bet that somebody in this room has been affected by methamphetamine, maybe not personally, but somewhere in your immediate family or maybe even your extended family. It's very rare you can get in a room with this many people and not find somebody that has some sort of experience with meth, and that should tell you something because there's not that many people in this room. But I'd be willing to bet lunch that somebody in here has a close relationship with the methamphetamine, and that just goes to show what kind of battle we're up against here. And it's gonna take legislation. And I should also disclaim myself and say that some of the opinions I gave here today are my opinions, not that of the Nebraska State Patrol. But so just throw that waiver out there. But if you had any questions, I'd answer them. That's pretty much all I have.
I think the law enforcement and substance treatment programs need to work together on this particular problem. In fact, if you look at some of the states that have done this, if these individuals are incarcerated, that's not all a bad deal. In fact, many of them that are incarcerated, if there are not other problems that they've done or serious crimes, in some states they put them into treatment. And the longer they're in treatment, the better the outcome. And I guess that would be my take-home message. It's both forces working together, and then length of treatment is a real key issue for these individuals.
We're about out of time. I certainly want to thank our panelists, Investigator Jason Scott and Dr. Todd Stull, for taking the time today to help spread the word about the serious dangers of methamphetamine. Thank you both.
Thank you.
And our thanks as well to our audience here at the Omaha Press Club for their excellent questions, and to our KIOS radio audience. And finally, the topic of next month's forum on June 15th will be immigration. Again, thank you both. We are adjourned.
You've been listening to a luncheon broadcast from the Omaha Press Club. We've heard a discussion of the topic, methamphetamine, its dangers, and treatment. The participants were Jason Scott, who's been with the Nebraska State Patrol for the past 8 years, and the Commercial Drug Interdiction Unit for the past 2 years, and Todd Stull, assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, and the medical director of the University Drug and Alcohol Program. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Thursday, May 18, 2006, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to the Omaha Press Club Education Committee for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The Omaha Press Club holds these noontime educational forums each month. If you'd like to attend future forums in the series, call the Omaha Press Club at 345-8008. These events are open to both members and non-members of the Omaha Press Club. The Omaha Press Club is located on the 22nd floor of the First National Center, 16th and Dodge, in downtown Omaha. Complete noon forum listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.